did so. "Good afternoon, Mrs. Gartnick," the man who was seated on my side of the table replied.
"Mr. Henry," said Agnes, her smile wavering. "Tab, you didn't say you were coming today."
"I'm not sure we have to inform you of all our movements, do we, Agnes?" Tabitha said.
"And who might you be?"
The elderly gentleman on my right turned to me. I was about to say I was Agnes's friend from London, but realized that was now going to be impossible. "I'm Louisa," I said, "Louisa Clark."
"Emmett Henry,"
he said, holding out a gnarled hand. "Delighted to meet you. Is that an English accent?"
"It is."
I looked up to thank a waitress who was pouring me some water.
"How very delightful. And are you over visiting?"
"Louisa works as Agnes's assistant, Emmett." Tabitha's voice lifted across the table.
"Agnes has developed the most extraordinary habit of bringing her staff to social occasions."
My cheeks flooded with color. I felt the burn of Catherine Gopnik's scrutiny along with the eyes of the rest of the table. Emmett considered this.
"Well, you know, my Dora took her nurse Libby with her absolutely everywhere for the last 10 years. Restaurant, the theater, wherever we went. She used to say old Libby was a better conversationalist than I was."
He patted my hand and chuckled, and several other people at the table joined in obligingly.
"I dare say she was right."
And just like that, I was saved from social ignominy by an 86-year-old man. Emmett Henry chatted to me through the shrimp starter, telling me about his long association with the country club, his years as a lawyer in Manhattan, his retirement to a senior citizens' facility a short distance away.
"I come here every day, you know. It keeps me active, and there are always people to talk to. It's my home from home."
"It's beautiful," I said, peering behind me. Several heads immediately turned away. "I can see why you'd want to come." Agnes seemed outwardly composed, but I could detect a slight tremor to her hands.
"Oh, this is a very historic building, dear."
Emmett was gesturing to the side of the room where a plaque stood. "It dates from..." He paused to ensure I had the full impact, then pronounced carefully,
1937.
I didn't like to tell him that in our street in England we had council housing older than that. I think Mum might even have had a pair of tights older than that. I nodded, smiled, ate my chicken with wild mushrooms, and wondered if there was any way I could move closer to Agnes, who was clearly miserable. The meal dragged. Emmett told me endless tales of the club, and amusing things said and done by people I had never heard of, and occasionally Agnes looked up and I smiled at her. But I could see her sinking. Glances flickered surreptitiously towards our table, and heads dipped towards heads.
The two Mrs. Gopniks sitting inches away from each other. Can you imagine?
After the main course, I excused myself from my seat. "Agnes, would you mind showing me where the ladies is?" I said. I figured even 10 minutes away from this room would help. Before she could answer, Catherine Gopnik placed her napkin on the table and turned to me.
"I'll show you, dear. I'm headed that way."
She picked up her handbag and stood beside me, waiting. I glanced at Agnes, but she didn't move. Agnes nodded.
"You go. I'll finish my chicken," she said.
I followed Mrs. Gopnik through the tables of the great room and out into the hallway, my mind racing. We walked along a carpeted corridor, me a few paces behind her, and stopped at the ladies. She opened the mahogany door and stood back, allowing me in before her. "Thank you," I muttered, and headed into a cubicle. I didn't even want to wee. I sat on the seat. If I stayed there long enough, she might leave before I came out. But when I emerged, she was at the basins, touching up her lipstick. Her gaze slid towards me as I washed my hands.
"So, you live in my old home," she said.
"Yes." There didn't seem much point in lying about it. She pursed her lips, then, satisfied, closed her lipstick.
"This must all feel rather awkward for you."
"I just do my job." She took out a small hairbrush and dragged it lightly over her hair. I wondered if it would be rude to leave, or if etiquette said I should also return to the table with her. I dried my hands and leant towards the mirror, checking under my eyes for smudges and taking as much time as possible.
"How is my husband?"
I blinked.
"Leonard, how is he? Surely you're not betraying any great confidence by telling me that."
Her reflection looked at me.
I
I don't see him much, but he seems fine. I was wondering why he wasn't here. Whether his arthritis had flared up again. Oh, no, I think he has a work thing today. A work thing? Well, I suppose that's good news. She placed the hairbrush carefully back in her bag and pulled out a powder compact. She patted her nose once, twice on each side before closing it. I was running out of things to do. I rummaged in my bag, trying to remember if I had brought a powder compact with me. And then Mrs. Gopnik turned to face me. Is he happy? I'm sorry. It's a straightforward question. My heart bumped awkwardly against my ribcage. Her voice was mellifluous even. Tab won't talk to me about him. She's quite angry at her father still, though she loves him desperately. Always was a daddy's girl. So I don't think it's possible for her to paint an accurate picture. Mrs. Gopnik, with respect, I really don't think it's my place to... She turned her head away. No, I suppose not. She placed the compact carefully in her handbag. I'm pretty sure I can guess what you've been told about me, Miss... Clark. Miss Clark. And I'm sure you're also aware that life is rarely black and white. I do, I swallowed. I also know Agnes is a good person. Smart, kind, cultured, and not a gold digger. As you say, these things are rarely clear-cut. Her eyes met mine in the glass. We stood for a few seconds longer. Then she closed her handbag, and after a glance at her reflection, she gave a tight smile. I'm glad Leonard is well. We returned to the table just as the plates were being cleared. She said not another word to me for the rest of the afternoon. The desserts were served alongside the coffee. The conversation ebbed and lunch dragged to a close. Several elderly ladies were helped to the ladies, their walking frames extricated with gentle commotions from chair legs as they went. The man in the suit stood on the small podium at the front, sweating gently into his collar, thanked everybody for coming, then said a few words about upcoming events at the club, including a charity night in 2 weeks, which was apparently sold out. A round of applause greeted this news. Finally, he said, they had an announcement to make, and nodded towards our table. Agnes let out a breath and stood, the room's eyes upon her. She walked to the podium, taking the manager's place at the microphone. She waited. He brought an older African-American woman in a dark suit to the front of the room. The woman fluttered her hands as if everyone were making an unnecessary fuss. Agnes smiled at her, took a deep breath as I had instructed her, then laid her two small cards carefully on the stand, and began to speak, her voice clear and deliberate. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming today, and thank you to all the staff for such a delicious lunch. Her voice was perfectly modulated, the words polished like stones over hours of practice the previous week. There was an approving murmur. I glanced at Miss Gopnik, whose expression was unreadable. As many of you know, this is Mary Lanter's last day at the club. We would like to wish her a very happy retirement. Leonard wishes me to tell you, Mary, he is so very sorry not to be able to come today. He appreciates everything you have done for the club, and he knows that everyone here does too. She paused, as I had instructed her. The room was silent, the women's faces attentive. Mary started here at Grand Pines in 1967 as a kitchen attendant and rose up to become assistant house manager. Everybody here has very much enjoyed your company and your hard work over the years, Mary. And we will all miss you very much. We and the other members of this club would like to offer you a small token of our appreciation, and we sincerely hope that your retirement is most enjoyable. There was a polite round of applause, and Agnes was handed a glass sculpture of a scroll with Mary's name engraved on it. She handed it to the older woman, smiling, and stood still as some people took pictures. Then she moved to the edge of the platform and returned to our table, her face flashing relief as she was allowed to leave the limelight. I watched as Mary smiled for pictures, this time with the manager. I was about to lean over to Agnes to congratulate her, when Catherine Gopnik stood. "Actually," she said, her voice cutting across the chatter, "I'd like to say a few words." As we watched, she made her way up onto the podium, where she walked past the stand. She took Mary's gift from her and handed it to the manager. Then she clasped Mary's hands in her own. "Oh, Mary," she said. Then, turning so that they were facing outward, "Mary, Mary, Mary, what a darling you've been." There was a spontaneous burst of applause across the room. Mrs. Gopnik nodded, waiting until it died down. "Over the years, my daughter has grown up with you watching over her, and us, during the hundreds, no, thousands of hours we've spent here. Such happy, happy times. If we've had the slightest problem, you've always been there, sorting things out, bandaging scraped knees or putting endless ice packs on a bumped head. I think we all remember the incident at the boathouse." There was a ripple of laughter. "You've especially loved our children, and this place always felt like a sanctuary to Leonard and me, because it was the one place we knew our family would be safe and happy. Those beautiful lawns have seen so many great times and been witness to so much laughter. While we'd be off playing golf or having a delicious cocktail with friends there at the sidelines, you'd be watching over children or handing out glasses of that inimitable iced tea. We all love Mary's special iced tea, don't we, friends?" There was a cheer. I watched as Agnes grew rigid, clapping robotically as if she wasn't quite sure what else to do. Emmett leant into me.
"Mary's iced tea is quite a thing. I don't know what she puts into it, but my goodness, it's lethal."
He raised his eyes to the heavens. "Tabitha came out specially from the city, like so many of us today, because I know that she thinks of you not just as staff at this club, but as part of the family. And we all know there's no substitute for family." I dared not look at Agnes now, as the applause broke out again.
"Mary," Catherine Gopnik said when it had died down, "you have helped perpetuate the true values of this place, values that some may find old-fashioned, but which we feel makes this country club what it is. Consistency, excellence, and loyalty. You have been its smiling face, its beating heart. I know I speak for everyone when I say it simply won't be the same without you."
The older woman was now beaming, her eyes glittering with tears.
"Everyone, charge your glasses and raise them to our wonderful Mary."
The room erupted. Those who were able to stand stood. As Emmett clambered unsteadily to his feet, I glanced around and then, feeling somehow treacherous, I did too. Agnes was the last to rise from her chair, still clapping, her smile a glossy rictus on her face. There was something comforting about a truly heaving bar, one where you had to thrust your arm through a queue three deep to get the attention of a bartender, and where you'd be lucky if two-thirds of your drink remained in the glass by the time you'd fought your way back to your table. Balthazar, Nathan told me, was something of a Soho institution, always jammed, always fun, a staple of the New York bar scene. And tonight, even on a Sunday, it was packed, busy enough for the noise, the ever-moving barmen, the lights and the clatter to drive the day's events from my head. We sank a couple of beers each, standing at the bar, and Nathan introduced me to the guys he knew from his gym, whose names I forgot almost immediately, but who were funny and nice and just needed one woman as an excuse to bounce cheerful insults off each other. Eventually, we fought our way to a table, where I drank some more and ate a cheeseburger and felt a bit better. At around 10 o'clock, when the boys were busy doing grunting impressions of other gym-goers, complete with facial expressions and bulging veins, I got up to go to the bathroom. I stayed there for 10 minutes, relishing the relative silence as I touched up my makeup and ruffled my hair. I tried not to think about what Sam was doing. It had stopped being a comfort to me, and had instead started to give me a knot in my stomach. Then I headed back out.
"Are you stalking me?"
I spun round in the corridor. There stood Joshua Ryan, in a shirt and jeans, his eyebrow raised. What? Oh, hi! My hand instinctively went to my hair. No, no, I'm just here with some friends.
I'm kidding you. How are you, Louisa Clark? Long way from Central Park.
He stooped to kiss my cheek. He smelt delicious, of limes and something soft and musky.
Wow, that was almost poetic.
Just working my way through all the bars in Manhattan. You know how it is.
Oh, yeah, the try something new thing.
You look cute. I like the whole...
He gestured towards my shift dress and long-sleeved cardigan. Preppy vibe.
Oh, I had to go to a country club today.
It's a good look on you. Want to grab a beer?
I can't really leave my friends.
He looked momentarily disappointed.
But, hey, I added, come and join us.
Great, let me tell the people I'm with. I'm tagging along on a date. They'll be glad to shake me. Where are you?
I fought my way back to Nathan. My face skin suddenly flushed and a faint buzzing in my ears. It didn't matter how wrong his accent, how different his eyebrows, the slant at the edge of his eyes that went the wrong way. It was impossible to look at Josh and not see Will there. I wondered if it would ever stop jolting me. I wondered at my unconscious internal use of the word ever.
I bumped into a friend, I said, just as Josh appeared.
A friend? Said Nathan.
Nathan, Dean, Aaron, this is Josh Ryan.
You forgot the third. He grinned at me, like we'd exchanged a private joke.
Hey!
Josh held out a hand, leant forward and shook Nathan's. I saw Nathan's eyes travel over him and flicker towards me. I raised a bright, neutral smile, as if I had loads of good-looking male friends dotted all over Manhattan, who might just want to come and join us in bars.
Can I buy anyone a beer?
Said Josh. They do great food here, too, if anyone's interested.
A friend? Murmured Nathan as Josh stepped up to the bar.
Yes, a friend. I met him at the Yellow Ball with Agnes.
He looks like...
I know. Nathan considered this. He looked at me, then at Josh.
That whole saying yes thing of yours. You haven't...
I love Sam, Nathan.
Sure you do, mate. I'm just saying.
I felt Nathan's scrutiny during the rest of the evening. Josh and I somehow ended up on the edge of a table away from everyone else, where he talked about his job and the insane mixture of opiates and antidepressants his work colleagues shoved into themselves every day, just to cope with the demands of the office, and how hard he was trying not to offend his easily offended boss, and how he kept failing. And the apartment he never had time to decorate, and what had happened when his clean freak mother visited from Boston. I nodded and smiled and listened, and tried to make sure that when I found myself watching his face it was in an appropriate, interested way, rather than a slightly obsessive, wistful, oh, but you're so like him, way.
And how about you, Louisa Clark? You've said almost nothing about yourself all evening. How's the holiday going? When do you have to head back?
The job. I realized with a lurch that the last time we had met, I had lied about who I was, and also that I was too drunk to maintain any kind of lie, or to feel as ashamed as I probably should about confessing. Josh, I have to tell you something. He leant forward.
Ah, you're married.
Nope.
Well, that's something. You have an incurable disease. Weeks left to live.
I shook my head.
You're bored.
You're bored. You'd rather talk to someone else now. I get it. I've barely drawn breath. I started to laugh. No, not that. You're great company. I looked down at my feet. I'm not who I told you I was. I'm not Agnes's friend from England. I just said that because she needed an ally at the Yellow Ball. I'm her assistant.
I'm just an assistant.
When I looked up, he was gazing at me.
And?
I stared at him. His eyes had tiny flecks of gold in them.
Louisa, this is New York. Everyone talks themselves up. Every bank teller is a junior vice president. Every bartender has a production company. I guessed you had to work for Agnes because of the way you were running around after her. No friend would do that, unless they were, like, really stupid, which you, plainly, are not.
And you don't mind?
Hey, I'm just glad you're not married. Unless you are married. That bit wasn't a lie, too, was it?
He had taken hold of one of my hands. I felt my breath give slightly in my chest, and I had to swallow before I spoke.
No, but I do have a boyfriend.
He kept his eyes on mine, perhaps searching to see whether there was some punchline coming, then released my hand reluctantly.
Ah, well, that's a pity. He leant back in his chair and took a sip of his drink. So how come he isn't here?
Because he's in England.
And he's coming over?
No.
He pulled a face, the kind of face people make when they think you're doing something stupid, but don't want to say so out loud. He shrugged.
Then we can be friends. You know everyone dates here, right? Doesn't have to be a thing. I'll be your incredibly handsome male walker.
Do you mean dating as in having sex with?
Whoa! You English girls don't mince your words.
I just don't want to lead you down the garden path.
You're telling me this isn't going to be a friends with benefits thing?
Okay, Louisa Clark. I get it. I tried not to smile and failed.
You're very cute, he said.
And you're funny.
And direct.
And not like any girl I've ever met.
And you're very charming.
That's because I'm a little enraptured.
And I'm a little bit drunk.
Oh, now I'm wounded, really wounded. He clutched at his heart.
It was at this point that I turned my head and saw Nathan watching. He gave a faint lift to his eyebrow, then tapped his wrist. It was enough to bring me back to earth.
You know, I really have to go. Early start. I've gone too far. I frightened you off.
Oh, I'm not that easily frightened, but I do have a tricky day at work tomorrow, and my morning run doesn't work so well on several pints of beer and a tequila chaser.
Will you call me for a platonic beer, so I can moon at you a little?
I have to warn you, mooning means something quite different in England.
I told him, and he exploded with laughter.
Well, I promise not to do that.
Unless, of course, you want me to.
That's quite the offer.
I mean it. Call me.
I walked out, feeling his eyes on my back the whole way. As Nathan hailed a yellow taxi, I turned as the door was closing. I could only just make him out through a tiny gap as it swung shut, but it was enough to see he was still watching me, and smiling. I called Sam.
Hey,
I said when he picked up.
Lou? Why am I even asking? Who else would ring me at 4:45 in the morning?
So what are you doing? I lay back on my bed and let my shoes drop from my feet onto the carpeted floor.
Just back off a shift, reading.
How are you?
You sound cheerful.
Been to a bar.
Tough day, but I feel a lot better now.
And I just wanted to hear your voice, because I miss you.
And you're my boyfriend.
And you're drunk, he laughed.
I might be, a little.
Did you say you were reading?
Yep, a novel.
Really? I thought you didn't read fiction.
Oh, Katie got it for me, insisted I'd enjoy it. I can't face the endless inquisitions if I keep not reading it.
She's buying you books.
I pushed myself upright, my good mood suddenly dissipating.
Why, what does buying me a book mean?
He sounded half amused.
It means she fancies you.
It does not.
It totally does.
Alcohol had loosened my inhibitions. I felt the words coming before I could stop them.
If women try to make you read something, it's because they fancy you. They want to be in your head. They want to make you think of stuff.
I heard him chuckle. And what if it's a motorcycle repair manual?
Still counts, because then she'd be trying to show you what a cool, sexy, motorbike-loving kind of chick she is.
Well, this isn't about motorbikes. It's some French thing.
French?
Oh, this is bad.
What's the title?
Madame de...
Madame de what?
Just Madame de.
It's about a general and some earrings and...
And what?
He has an affair.
She's making you read books about French people who have affairs.
Oh, my God, she totally fancies you.
You're wrong, Lou.
I know when someone fancies someone, Sam.
Really?
He had begun to sound tired.
So a man made a pass at me tonight. I knew he fancied me, so I told him straight off I was with someone. I headed it off.
Oh, you did?
Who was that, then?
His name is Josh.
Josh.
Would that be the same Josh who called you when I was leaving?
Even through my slightly drunken fug, I had begun to realise this conversation was a bad idea.
Yes? And you just happened to bump into him in a bar?
I did! I was there with Nathan, and I literally ran into him outside the ladies.
So what did he say?
His voice now had a faint edge.
He...
He said it was a pity.
And is it?
What?
A pity. There was a short silence. I felt suddenly horribly sober.
I'm just telling you what he said. I'm with you, Sam. I'm literally just using this as an example of how I could tell that someone fancied me and how I headed it off before he got the wrong idea, which is a concept you seem to be unwilling to grasp.
No, seems to me you're calling me up in the middle of the night to have a go at me about my work partner, who has lent me a book. But you're fine with you going out and having drunken conversations with this Josh about relationships.
Jesus, you wouldn't even admit we were in a relationship until I pushed you into it. And now you'll happily talk about intimate stuff to some guy you just met in a bar. If you really just met him in a bar.
It just took some time, Sam. I thought you were playing around.
It took you time because you were still in love with the memory of another guy. A dead guy. And now you're in New York because, well, he wanted you to go there. So I have no idea why you're being weird and jealous about Katie. You never minded how much time I spent with Donna. Because Donna didn't fancy you.
You've never even met Katie. How could you possibly know whether she fancies me or not? I've seen the pictures.
What pictures?
He exploded. I shut my eyes. I was an idiot. I closed my eyes. On her Facebook page, she has pictures of you and her, I swallowed.
A picture.
There was a long silence. The kind of silence that says, are you serious? The kind of ominous silence that comes while somebody quietly adjusts his view of who you are. When Sam spoke again, his voice was low and controlled. This is a ridiculous discussion, and I've got to get some sleep.
Sam, I...
Go to sleep, Lou. We'll speak later. He rang off. Chapter 12. I barely slept. All the things I wished I had and hadn't said whirring around in my head in an endless carousel, and woke groggily to the sound of knocking. I stumbled out of bed and opened my door to find Mrs. DeWitt standing there in her dressing gown. She looked tiny and frail without her makeup and set hair, and her face was twisted with anxiety.
"Oh, you there," she said,
like I would have been anywhere else.
"Come, come, I need your help."
What? Who let you in?
The big one, the Australian. Come on, no time to waste.
I rubbed my eyes, struggling to come to.
He's helped me before, but said he couldn't leave Mr. Gopnik. Oh, what does it matter? I opened my door this morning to put my trash out, and Dean Martin ran out, and he's somewhere in the building. I have no idea where. I can't find him myself.
Her voice was quavering yet imperious, and her hands fluttered around her head.
Hurry, hurry now. I'm afraid somebody will open the doors downstairs and he'll get out onto the sidewalk.
She wrung her hands together.
He's not good by himself outdoors, and someone might steal him. He's a pedigree, you know.
I grabbed my key and followed her out into the hall, still in my T-shirt.
Where have you looked?
Well, nowhere, dear. I'm not good at walking. That's why I need you to do it. I'm going to go and get my stick.
She looked at me as if I had said something particularly stupid. I sighed, trying to imagine what I would do if I were a small, wonky-eyed pug with an unexpected taste of freedom.
"He's all I have. You have to find him."
She started to cough as if her lungs couldn't cope with the tension. "I'll try the main lobby first." I ran downstairs, on the basis that Dean Martin was unlikely to be able to call the lift, and scanned the corridor for a small, angry canine. Empty. I checked my watch, noting with mild dismay that this was because it was not yet 6 a.m. I peered behind and under Ashok's desk, then ran to his office, which was locked. I called Dean Martin's name softly the whole time, feeling faintly stupid as I did so. No sign. I ran back up the stairs and did the same thing on our floor, checking the kitchen and back corridors. Nothing. I did the same on the second, third, and fourth floors, before rationalising that if I was now out of breath, the chances of a small, fat pug being able to run up that many flights of stairs at speed was pretty unlikely. And then outside I heard the familiar whine of the refuse truck, and I thought about our old dog, who had a particular ability to tolerate, and even enjoy, the most disgusting smells known to humanity. I headed to the service entrance. There, entranced, stood Dean Martin, drooling as the men wheeled the huge, stinking bins backwards and forwards from our building to their truck. I approached him slowly, But the noise was so great and his attention so locked on the rubbish that he didn't hear me until the exact moment I reached down and grabbed him. Have you ever held a raging pug? I haven't felt anything squirm that hard since I had to pin a 2-year-old Tom down on a sofa while my sister extricated a rogue marble from his left nostril. As I wrestled Dean Martin under my arm, the dog threw himself left and right, his eyes bulging with fury, his outraged yapping filling the silent building. I had to wrap my arms around him, my head at an angle to stop his snapping jaw reaching me. From upstairs I heard Mrs. DeWitt calling down, "Dean Martin, is that him?" It took everything I had to hold him. I ran up the last flight of stairs, desperate to hand him over. "Got him," I gasped. Mrs. DeWitt stepped forward, her arms outstretched. She had a lead ready, and she reached out and snapped it onto his collar, just as I lowered him to the ground. At which point, with a speed wholly incommensurate with his size and shape, he whipped round and sank his teeth into my left hand. If there had been anyone left in the building who hadn't already been woken by the barking, my scream would probably have done it. It was at least loud enough to shock Dean Martin into letting go. I bent double over my hand and swore, the blood already blistering on the wound.
"Your dog bit me! He bloody bit me!"
Mrs. DeWitt took a breath and stood a little straighter. "Well, of course he did. With you holding him that tightly, he was probably desperately uncomfortable." She shooed the little dog inside where he continued to growl at me, teeth bared.
"There, see," she said, gesturing towards him. "Your shouting and screaming frightened him. He's terribly agitated now. You have to learn about dogs if you're going to handle them correctly."
I couldn't speak. My jaw had dropped, cartoon style. It was at this moment that Mr. Gopnik, in tracksuit bottoms and a T-shirt, threw open his front door.
"What on earth is this racket?"
he said, striding out into the corridor. I was startled by the ferocity of his voice. He took in the scene before him, me in my T-shirt and knickers, clutching my bleeding hand, and the old woman in her dressing gown, the dog snapping at her feet. Behind Mr. Gopnik I could just make out Nathan in his uniform, a towel raised to his face.
"What the hell is going on?" "Oh, ask the wretched girl. She started it."
Mrs. DeWitt scooped Dean Martin up in her thin arms again, then wagged a finger at Mr. Gopnik.
"And don't you dare lecture me on noise in this building, young man. Your apartment is a veritable Vegas casino with the amount of toings and froings. I'm amazed nobody has complained to Mr. Ovitz."
With her head high, she turned and shut the door. Mr. Gopnik blinked twice, looked at me, then back at the closed door. There was a short silence, and then unexpectedly, he began to laugh.
"Young man, well," he said, shaking his head, "it's a long time since anyone called me that."
He turned to Nathan behind him.
"You must be doing something right."
From somewhere inside the apartment, a muffled voice lifted in response.
"Don't flatter yourself, Gopnik."
Mr. Gopnik sent me in the car with Gary to get a tetanus shot from his personal physician. I sat in a waiting room that resembled the lounge of a luxury hotel and was seen by a middle-aged Iranian doctor, who was possibly the most solicitous person I had ever met. When I glanced at the bill to be paid by Mr. Gopnik's secretary, I forgot the bite and thought I might pass out instead. Agnes had already heard the story by the time I got back. I was apparently the talk of the building.
"You must sue," she said cheerfully. "She is awful troublemaking, old woman, and that dog is plainly dangerous. I am not sure it's safe for us to live in same building. Do you need time off? If you need time off, I can sue her for lost services."
I said nothing, nursing my dark feelings towards Mrs. DeWitt and Dean Martin.
"No good deed, guys, I'm punished, eh?"
Nathan said when I bumped into him in the kitchen. He held up my hand, checking out the bandage.
"Jeez, that little dog is ropeable."
But even as I felt quietly furious with her, I kept remembering what Mrs. DeWitt had said when she had first come to my door.
"He's all I have."
Although Tabitha moved back to her apartment that week, the mood in the building remained fractious, muted, and marked with occasional explosions. Mr. Gopnik continued to spend hours at work, while Agnes filled much of our time together on the phone to her mother in Polish. I got the feeling there was some kind of family crisis going on. Ilaria burnt one of Agnes's favourite shirts, a genuine accident, I believed, as she had been complaining about the temperature controls on the new iron for weeks, and when Agnes screamed at her that she was disloyal, a traitor, a suka, in her house,
and hurled the damaged shirt at her, Ilaria finally erupted and told Mr. Gopnik that she could not work here any more. It was impossible. Nobody could have worked harder and for less reward over these years. She could no longer stand it and was handing in her notice. Mr. Gopnik, with soft words and an empathetic head tilt, persuaded her to change her mind. He might also have offered hard cash. And this apparent act of betrayal caused Agnes to slam her door hard enough to topple the second little Chinese vase from the hall table with a musical crash, and for her to spend an entire evening weeping in her dressing room. When I appeared the next morning, Agnes was seated beside her husband at the breakfast table, her head resting on his shoulder as he murmured into her ear, their fingers entwined. She apologized formally to Ilaria as he watched, smiling, and when he left for work she swore furiously in Polish for the whole time it took us to jog around Central Park. That evening she announced she was going to Poland for a long weekend to see her family, and I felt a faint relief when I gathered she did not want me to come too. Sometimes being in that apartment, enormous as it was, with Agnes's ever-changing moods and the swinging tensions between her and Mr. Gopnik, Ilaria and his family felt impossibly claustrophobic. The thought of being alone for a few days felt like a little oasis. "What would you like me to do while you're gone?" I said. "Have some days off," she said, smiling. "You are my friend, Louisa. I think you must have a nice time while I'm away." "Oh, I'm so excited to see my family. I'm so excited." She clapped her hands. "Just to Poland. No stupid charity things to go to. I am so happy." I remembered how reluctant she had been to leave her husband, even for a night when I had arrived, and pushed the thought away. When I walked back into the kitchen, still pondering this change, Ilaria was crossing herself. "Are you okay, Ilaria?" "I'm praying," she said, not looking up from her pan. "Is everything all right?" "He's fine. I'm praying that that puta doesn't come back again." I emailed Sam, the germ of an idea flooding me with excitement. I would have rung him, but he had been silent since our phone call, and I was afraid he was still annoyed with me. I told him I'd been given an unexpected 3-day weekend, had looked up flights and thought I might splurge on an unexpected trip home. So how about it? What else were wages for? I signed it with a smiley face, an aeroplane emoji, and some hearts and kisses. The answer came back within an hour. "Sorry, I'm working flat out, and Saturday night I promised to take Jake to the O2 to see some band. It's a nice idea, but this isn't a great weekend. S. Kiss." I stared at the email and tried not to feel chilled. "It's a nice idea?" It was as if I'd suggested a casual stroll around the park. "Is he calling on me?" Nathan read it twice. "No, he's telling you he's busy and this isn't a great time for you to come home unexpectedly." "He's cooling on me. There's nothing in that email. No love, no desire. Or he might have been on his way to work when he wrote it. Or on the john. Or talking to his boss. He's just being a bloke." I didn't buy it. I knew Sam. I stared at those two lines again and again, trying to dissect their tone, their hidden intent. I went on Facebook, hating myself for doing so, and checked to see whether Katie Ingram had announced that she was doing something special that weekend. Annoyingly, she hadn't posted anything at all, which was exactly what you would do if you were planning to seduce someone else's hot paramedic boyfriend. And then I took a breath and wrote him a response. Well, several responses, but this was the only one I didn't delete. "No problem. It was a long shot. Hope you have a lovely time with Jake. L. Kiss." And then I pressed send, marvelling at how far the words of an email could deviate from what you actually felt. Agnes left on the Thursday evening, laden with gifts. I waved her off with big smiles and collapsed in front of the television. On Friday morning, I went to an exhibition of Chinese opera costumes at the Met Costume Institute, and spent an hour admiring the intricately embroidered, brightly coloured robes, the mirrored sheen of the silks. From there, inspired, I travelled to West 37th to visit some fabric and haberdashery stores I had looked up the previous week. The October day was cool and crisp, heralding the onset of winter. I took the subway and enjoyed its grubby, foggy warmth. I spent an hour scanning the shelves, losing myself among the bolts of patterned fabric. I had decided to put together my own mood board for Agnes for when she returned, covering the little chaise longue and the cushions with bright, cheerful colours, jade greens and pinks,
gorgeous prints with parrots and pineapples. Far from the muted damasks and drapes that the expensive interior decorators kept offering her. Those were all first Mrs. Gopnik colours. Agnes needed to put her own stamp on the apartment. Something bold and lively and beautiful. I explained what I was doing, and the woman at the desk told me about another shop in the East Village, a second-hand clothes outfit where they kept bolts of vintage fabric at the back. It was an unpromising storefront, a grubby 1970s exterior that promised a vintage clothing emporium, all decades, all styles, low prices. But I walked in and stopped in my tracks. The shop was a warehouse, set with carousels of clothes and distinct sections under homemade signs that said 1940s, 1960s, clothes that dreams are made of, and bargain corner, no shame in a ripped seam. The air smelt musky, of decades-old perfume, moth-eaten fur, and long-forgotten evenings out. I gulped in the scent like oxygen, feeling as if I had somehow recovered a part of myself I had barely known I was missing. I trailed around the store, trying on armfuls of clothes by designers I had never heard of, their names a whispered echo of some long-forgotten age. Tailored by Michelle, Fonseca of New Jersey, Miss Aramis. Running my fingers over invisible stitching, placing Chinese silks and chiffon against my cheek. I could have bought a dozen things, but I finally settled on a teal blue fitted cocktail dress with huge fur cuffs and a scoop neck. I told myself fur didn't count if it dated from 60 years ago. A pair of vintage denim railroad dungarees and a checked shirt that made me want to chop down a tree or maybe ride a horse with a swishy tail. I could have stayed there all day. "I've had my eye on that dress for so long," said the girl at the checkout as I placed it on the counter. She was heavily tattooed, her dyed black hair swept up in a huge chignon, and her eyes lined with dark kohl. "But I couldn't get my tush into it. You look cute." Her voice was raspy, thickened by cigarettes, and impossibly cool. "I have no idea where I'll wear it, but I have to have it." "That's how I feel about clothes all the time. They talk to you, right? That dress has been screaming at me, 'Buy me, you idiot, and maybe lay off the potato chips.'" She stroked it. "Bye-bye, little blue friend. I'm sorry I let you down."
"Your store is amazing."
"Oh, we're hanging in here. Buffeted by the cruel winds of rent rises and Manhattanites who would rather go to TJ Maxx than buy something original and beautiful. Look at that quality." She held up the lining of the dress, pointing to the tiny stitches. "How are you going to get work like that out of some sweatshop in Indonesia? Nobody in the whole of New York State has a dress like this." She raised her eyebrows. "Except you, British lady. Where is that beauty from?"
I was wearing a green military greatcoat that my dad joked smelt like it had been in the Crimean War, and a red beanie. Underneath, I had my turquoise Dr. Martin boots, a pair of tweed shorts and tights.
"I'm loving that look. You ever want to offload that coat, I could sell it like that."
She snapped her finger so loudly that my head shot backwards.
"Military coats. Never get tired. I have a red infantry coat that my grandma swears she stole from a guardsman at Buckingham Palace. I cut the back off and turned it into a bum freezer. You know what a bum freezer is, right? You want to see a picture?"
I did. We bonded over that short jacket, the way other people bond over pictures of babies. Her name was Lydia, and she lived in Brooklyn. She and her sister Angelica had inherited the store from their parents 7 years previously. They had a small but loyal clientele, and were mostly kept afloat by visits from TV and film costume designers, who would buy things to rip apart and retailor. Most of their clothes, she said, came from estate sales.
"Florida is the best. You have these grandmas with huge air-conditioned closets stuffed full of cocktail dresses from the 1950s that they never got rid of. We fly down there every couple of months and mostly restock from grieving relatives. But it's getting harder. There's so much competition these days."
She gave me a card with their website and email.
"You ever have anything you want to sell, you just give me a call."
"Lydia," I said, when she had packed my clothes with tissue and placed them in a bag, "I think I'm a buyer more than a seller. But thank you. Your store is the greatest. You're the greatest. I feel like I'm at home."
"You are adorable."
She said this with no change in her facial expression whatsoever. She held up a finger, then stooped below the counter. She came up bearing a pair of vintage sunglasses, dark with pale blue plastic frames.
"Someone left these here months ago. I was going to put them up for sale, but
It just occurred to me they would look fabulous on you, especially in that dress.
I probably shouldn't, I began. I've already spent so...
Shh, a gift. So now you're indebted to us, and you have to come back.
There. How cute do you look in those?
She held up a mirror.
I have to admit, I did look cute.
I adjusted the shades on my nose.
Well, this is officially my best day in New York.
Lydia, I'll see you next week, and basically spend all my money in here from now on.
Cool. This is how we emotionally blackmail our customers into keeping us afloat.
She lit a Sobrani and waved me off. I spent the afternoon putting together the mood board and trying on my new clothes, and suddenly it was 6 o'clock, and I was sitting on my bed tapping my fingers on my knees. I had been thrilled with the idea of having time to myself, but now the evening stretched in front of me like a bleak, featureless landscape. I texted Nathan, who was still with Mr. Gopnik, to see if he wanted to go out for a bite to eat after work. But he had a date, and said so nicely, but in the way that people do when they really don't need a gooseberry tagging along. I thought about calling Sam again, but I no longer had faith that our phone calls were going to happen in real life the way they happened in my head. And although I kept staring at the phone, my fingers never quite made it to the digits. I thought about Josh, and wondered whether if I called him up and asked to meet him for a drink, he would think it meant something. And then I wondered if the fact that I wanted to meet him for a drink did actually mean something. I checked Katie Ingram's Facebook page, but she still hadn't posted. And then I headed into the kitchen before I could do anything else that stupid, and asked Ilaria if she wanted any help making supper, which caused her to rock on her black slippered heel and stare at me suspiciously for a full 10 seconds.
"You want to help me make supper?"
"Yes," I said, and smiled.
"No,"
she said, and turned away. Until that evening, I hadn't realized quite how few people I knew in New York. I'd been so busy since I'd arrived, and my life had been so comprehensively based around Agnes, her schedule and needs, that it hadn't occurred to me that I hadn't made any friends of my own. But there was something about a Friday night in the city with no plans that made you feel like, well, like a bit of a loser. I walked to the good sushi place and bought miso soup and some sashimi I hadn't had before, and tried not to think, "Eel, I'm actually eating eel," and drank a beer, and then lay on my bed, flicked through the channels and pushed away thoughts of other things, such as what Sam was doing. I told myself I was in New York, the centre of the universe. So what if I was having a Friday night in? I was simply resting after a week of my demanding New York job. I could go out any night of the week if I really wanted to. I told myself this several times. And then my phone pinged. "You out exploring New York's finest bars again?" I knew who it was without looking. Something inside me lurched. I hesitated a moment before responding. "Just having a night in, actually. Fancy a friendly beer with an exhausted corporate wage slave? If nothing else, you could make sure I don't go home with an unsuitable woman." I started to smile, and then I typed, "What makes you think I'm any kind of defense? Are you saying we look like we could never be together? Oh, that's harsh." "I meant, what makes you think I'd stop you going home with someone else?" "The fact that you're even responding to my messages." He added a smiley face to this. I stopped typing, feeling suddenly disloyal. I stared at my phone, watching the cursor wink impatiently. In the end, he typed, "Did I blow it? I just blew it, didn't I? Damn, Louisa Clark. I just wanted a beer with a pretty girl on a Friday night. And I was prepared to overlook the feeling of vague dejection that comes with knowing she's in love with someone else. That's how much I enjoy your company. Come for a beer." "One beer?" I lay back on the pillow thinking. I closed my eyes and groaned. And then I sat up and typed, "I'm really sorry, Josh. I can't. Kiss." He didn't respond. I had offended him. I would never hear from him again. And then my phone pinged. "Okay, well, if I get in trouble, I'm texting you first thing tomorrow morning to come get me and pretend to be my crazy jealous girlfriend. Be prepared to hit hard. Deal?" I found I was laughing. "The least I can do. Have a good night. Kiss."
"You too. Not too good, though. The only thing keeping me going right now is the thought of you secretly regretting not coming out with me. Kiss."
I did regret it a little. Of course I did. There are only so many episodes of The Big Bang Theory a girl can watch. I turned the television off and I stared at the ceiling, and I thought about my boyfriend on the other side of the world, and I thought about an American who looked like Will Traynor and actually wanted to spend time with me,
not a girl with wild blonde hair who looked like she wore sequin G-strings under her uniform. I thought about ringing my sister, but I didn't want to disturb Tom. For the first time since I had arrived in America, I had an almost physical sense of being in the wrong place, as if I were being tugged by invisible cords to somewhere a million miles away. At one point, I felt so bad that I walked into my bathroom and saw a large chestnut-coloured cockroach on the sink, and I didn't scream, like I had previously, but briefly considered making it a pet, like a character in a children's novel. And then I realised that I was now officially thinking like a madwoman, and sprayed it with Raid instead. At 10, irritable and restless, I walked to the kitchen and stole two of Nathan's beers, leaving an apologetic note under his door, and drank them, one after the other, gulping so fast that I had to suppress a huge belch. I felt bad about that damned cockroach. What was he doing after all? Just going about his cockroachy business? Maybe he'd been lonely. Maybe he'd wanted to make friends with me. I went and peered under the basin where I'd kicked him, but he was definitely dead. This made me irrationally angry. I thought you weren't meant to be able to kill cockroaches. I'd been lied to about cockroaches. I added this to my list of things to feel furious about. I put my earphones in and sang my way drunkenly through some Beyoncé songs that I knew would make me feel worse, but somehow I didn't care. I scrolled through my phone, looking at the few pictures I had of Sam and me together, trying to detect the strength of his feelings from the way he put his arm around me, or the way he bent his head towards mine. I stared at them, and tried to recall what it was that had made me feel so sure, so secure in his arms. Then I picked up my laptop, clicked open an email, and addressed it to him. "Do you still miss me?" And as I pressed send, realizing, as it whooshed into the ether, that I had now condemned myself to at least 24 hours of email-related anxiety while I waited for him to respond. Chapter 13. I woke feeling sick, and it wasn't the beer. It took fewer than 10 seconds for the vague feeling of nausea to seep along a synapse and connect with a memory of what I had done the previous evening. I opened my laptop slowly and balled my fists into my eyes when I discovered that, yes, I had indeed sent it, and no, he hadn't responded, even when I pressed refresh 14 times. I lay in the fetal position for a bit, trying to make the knot in my stomach go away, and then I wondered about calling him and explaining lightly that, "Ha, I've been a bit merry and homesick, and I just wanted to hear his voice, and, you know, sorry." But he had told me he would be working all Saturday, which meant that right now he would be in the rig with Katie Ingram, and something in me balked at having that conversation with her in earshot. For the first time since I had come to work for the Gopniks, the weekend stretched out in front of me like an interminable journey over bleak terrain. So I did what every girl does when she's far from home and a little sad. I ate half a packet of chocolate digestives and called my mother. "Lou, is that you? Hold on, I'm in the middle of washing Grandad's smalls. Let me turn the hot water off." I heard my mother walking to the other side of the kitchen, the radio humming distantly in the background, abruptly silenced, and I was instantly transported to our little house in Renfrew Road. "Hello, I'm back. Is everything all right?" She sounded breathless. I pictured her untying her apron. She always removed her apron for important calls. "Fine. I've barely had a minute to talk properly, so I thought I'd give you a ring. Is it not fearful expensive? I thought you only wanted to send emails. You're not going to be hit with one of those £1,000 bills, are you? I saw a whole thing on the television about people getting caught out using their phones on holiday. You'd have to sell your house when you got home, just to get them off your back." I checked the rates. "It's good to hear your voice, Mum." Mum's delight at speaking to me made me feel a little ashamed for not having called before. She rattled on, telling me about how she planned to start the poetry night classes when Grandad was feeling better, and the Syrian refugees who had moved in at the end of the street. She was giving them English lessons. "Of course, I can't understand a thing they're saying half the time, but we draw pictures, you know. And Zina, that's the mother, she always cooks me a little something to say thank you. Oh, what she can do with flaky pastry, you wouldn't believe. Really, they're awful nice, the bunch of them." She said that Dad had been told to lose weight by the new doctor. Grandad's hearing was going and the television was on so loud that every time he turned it on, she nearly did a little wee. And Dimpner, from two doors down, was having a baby, and they could hear her retching morning, noon and night. I sat in my bed and listened, and felt oddly comforted that life continued as normal, somewhere else in the world.
Have you spoken to your sister?
Not for a couple of weeks. Why?
She lowered her voice as if Trina were in the room instead of 40 miles away. She has a man.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know? Well, what's he like? She won't tell us a thing. She's after going out with him 2 or 3 times a week now. She keeps humming and smiling when I talk about him. It's very odd.
Odd? To have your sister smiling so much.
I've been quite unnerved. I mean, it's lovely and all, but she's not herself. Lou, I went down to London to spend the night with her and Tom, so she could go out, and when she came back, she was singing.
Whoa.
I know. Almost in tune, too. I told your dad, and he accused me of being unromantic.
Unromantic?
I told him only someone who truly believed in romance could stay married after washing his undercrackers for 30 years.
Mum!
Oh, Lord, I forgot. You wouldn't have had your breakfast yet. Well, anyway, if you speak to her, try and get some information out of her.
How's your fella, by the way?
Sam?
Oh, he's fine.
That's grand. He came to your flat a couple of times after you'd gone. I think he just wanted to feel close to you, bless him. Trina said he was awful sad. Kept looking for jobs to do around the place. Came up here for a roast dinner with us too. But he hasn't been by for a while now.
He's really busy, Mum.
I'm sure he is. That's a job and a half, isn't it? Right, well, I must let you go before this call bankrupts the both of us.
Did I tell you I'm seeing Maria this week, the toilet attendant from that lovely hotel we went to back in August? I'm going to London to see Trina and Tom on Friday, and I'm going to pop in and have lunch with Maria first.
In the toilets?
Don't be ridiculous.
There's a 2-for-1 pasta deal at that Italian chain near Leicester Square.
Can't remember the name. She's very fussy about where she goes. She says you should judge a restaurant kitchen by the cleanliness of the ladies. This one has a very good maintenance schedule, apparently. Every hour on the hour.
Is everything good with you?
How's the glamorous life on 5th Street?
Avenue.
5th Avenue, Mum.
It's great. It's all amazing.
Don't forget to send me some pictures. I showed Mrs. Edwards that one of you at the Yellow Ball, and she said you looked like a film star.
Didn't say which one, but I know she meant well.
I was telling Daddy we should come and visit you before you're too important to know us.
Like that's going to happen.
We're awful proud, sweetheart.
Can't believe I have a daughter in New York high society, riding in limousines and hobnobbing with Flash Harrys.
I looked around my little room, with the 1980s wallpaper and the dead cockroach under the basin.
Yeah,
I said. I'm really lucky. I got dressed, trying not to think about the significance of Sam no longer stopping by my flat just to feel close to me. I drank a coffee and went downstairs. I would head back to the vintage clothes emporium. I had the feeling Lydia wouldn't mind if I just hung out. I picked my clothes carefully. This time I wore a Chinese Mandarin-style blouse in turquoise, with black wool culottes and a pair of red ballet slippers. Just the act of creating a look that didn't involve a polo shirt and nylon slacks made me feel more like myself. I tied my hair into 2 plaits, joined at the back with a little red bow. Then added the sunglasses Lydia had given me, and some earrings in the shape of the Statue of Liberty that had been irresistible, despite coming from a stall of tourist tat. I heard the commotion as I headed down the stairs. I wondered briefly what Mrs. DeWitt was up to now, but when I turned the corner, I saw that the raised voice was coming from a young Asian woman who appeared to be thrusting a small child at a shook.
"You said this was my day. You promised. I have to go to the march."
"I can't do it, baby. Vincent is off. They got nobody to mind the lobby."
"Then your kids can sit here while you do it. I'm going to this march, shook. They need me."
"I can't mind the kids here.
The library is going to close, baby. You understand that? You know that is the one place with aircon I can go in the summer. It is the one place I can feel sane. You tell me where else in the Heights I'm going to take these kids when I'm alone 18 hours a day."
The shook looked up as I stood there.
"Oh, hi, Miss Louisa."
She turned. I'm not sure what I'd expected of a shook's wife, but it was not this fierce-looking woman in jeans and a bandana, her curly hair tumbling down her back.
"Morning."
"Good morning," she said, turning away.
"I'm not discussing this any further, baby. You told me Saturday was mine. I am going on this march to protect a valuable public resource. That is it."
"There's another march next week."
"We have to keep up the pressure. This is the time when the city councilors decide funding. If we're not out there now, the local news doesn't report it, and then they think nobody cares. You know how PR works, baby. You know how the world works.
I will lose my job if my boss comes down here and sees three kids.
Yes, I love you, Nadia. I do love you.
Don't cry, sweetheart.
He turned to the toddler in his arms and kissed her wet cheek.
Daddy just has to do his job today.
I'm going now, baby. I'll be back early afternoon.
Don't go. Don't you dare. Hey!
She walked away, her palm up as if to ward off further protest, and swung out of the building, stooping to pick up a placard she'd left by the door. As if perfectly choreographed, all three small children began to cry. Ashok swore softly.
What the Sam Hill am I supposed to do now?
I'll do it, I said before, but I knew what I was doing.
What?
Nobody's in. I'll take them upstairs.
Are you serious?
Ilaria goes to see her sister on Saturdays. Mr. Gopnik's at his club. I'll park them in front of the television. How hard can it be?
He looked at me. You don't have children, do you, Miss Louisa? And then he recovered himself.
But, man, that would be a lifesaver. If Mr. Ovitz stops by and sees me with these three, I'll be fired before you can say,
He thought for a moment.
You're fired?
Exactly. Okay, let me come up with you and I'll explain who is who and who likes what. Hey, kids, you're going to have an adventure upstairs with Miss Louisa. How cool is that?
Three kids stared at me with wet, snotty faces. I smiled brightly at them, and in tandem, all three began to cry again. If you ever find yourself in a melancholy state of mind, removed from your family, and a little unsure about the person you love, I can highly recommend it being left in temporary charge of three small strangers, at least two of whom are still unable to go to the lavatory unaided. The phrase, living in the moment, only really made sense to me once I'd found myself chasing a crawling baby whose obscenely filled nappy hung half off across a priceless Aubusson rug, while simultaneously trying to stop a four-year-old chasing a traumatized cat. The middle child, a Bic, could be pacified with biscuits, and I parked him in front of cartoons in the TV room, shoveling crumbs with fat hands into his dribbling mouth, while I tried to shepherd the other two into at least the same 20 square feet radius. They were funny and sweet and mercurial and exhausting, squawking and running and colliding repeatedly with furniture. Vases wobbled, books were hauled from shelves and hastily shoved back. Noise and various unsavory scents filled the air. At one point, I sat on the floor clutching two around their waists, while Rachana, the eldest, poked me in the eye with sticky fingers and laughed. I laughed too. It was kind of funny, in a thank God this will all be over soon kind of way. After 2 hours, Ashok came up and told me his wife was caught up in her protest, and could I do another hour? I said yes. He wore the wide-eyed look of the truly desperate, and, after all, I had nothing else to do. I did, however, take the precaution of moving them into my room, where I put on some cartoons, tried to keep them from opening the door, and accepted, with some distant part of me, that the air in this part of the building might never smell the same again. I was just trying to stop Abik putting cockroach spray into his mouth when there was a knock on my door. "Hold on, Ashok," I yelled, trying to wrestle the canister off the child before his father saw. But it was Ilaria's face that appeared around my door. She stared at me, then at the children, then back at me. Abik briefly stopped crying, gazing at her with huge brown eyes.
"Hi, Ilaria."
She said nothing.
I'm just helping Ashok out for a couple of hours. I know it's not ideal, but, please don't say anything. They'll only be here a tiny bit longer.
She eyed the scene, then sniffed the air.
I'll fumigate the room afterwards. Please don't tell Mr. Gopnik. I promise it won't happen again. I know I should have asked first, but there was nobody here, and Ashok was desperate.
As I spoke, Rachana ran, wailing towards the older woman, and hurled herself like a rugby ball at her stomach. I winced as Ilaria staggered backwards.
They'll be gone any minute. I can call Ashok right now. Really, nobody has to know.
But Ilaria simply adjusted her blouse, then scooped the little girl up in one arm.
You are thirsty, compañera.
Without a backward glance, she shuffled off. Rachana huddled against her huge chest, her little thumb plugged into her mouth. As I sat there, Ilaria's voice echoed down the corridor.
Bring them to the kitchen.
Ilaria fried a batch of banana fritters, handing the children small pieces of banana to keep them occupied while she cooked. And I refilled cups of water and tried to stop the smaller children toppling off the kitchen chairs. She didn't talk to me, but kept up a low croon, her face filled with unexpected sweetness,
her voice low and musical as she chatted to them. The children, like dogs responding to an efficient trainer, were immediately quiet and biddable, holding out dimpled hands for another piece of banana, remembering their pleases and thank yous, according to Ilari's instructions. They ate and ate, growing smiley and placid. The baby rubbed bald fists into her eyes, as if she were ready for bed.
"Hungry?" Ilaria said, nodding towards the empty plates.
I tried to recall whether Ashok had told me about food in the baby's rucksack, but I'd been too distracted to look. I was just grateful to have a grown-up in the room.
"You're brilliant with kids," I said, chewing a piece of fritter.
She shrugged, but she looked quietly gratified.
"You should change the little one. We can make a bed for her in the bottom drawer."
I stared at her.
"Because she will fall out of your bed," she rolled her eyes, as if this had been obvious.
"Oh, sure." I took Nadia back to my room and changed her, wincing. I drew the curtains. And then I pulled out my bottom drawer, arranged my jumpers so that they lined it, and laid Nadia down inside them, waiting for her to go to sleep. She fought it at first, her big eyes staring at me, her fat, dimpled hands reaching up for mine. But I could tell it was a battle she would lose. I tried to copy Ilaria and softly sang a lullaby. Well, it wasn't, strictly speaking, a lullaby. The only thing I could remember the words to was the Mollahonky song, which just made her chuckle, and another about Hitler having only one testicle that Dad had sung when I was small. But the baby seemed to like it. Her eyes began to close. I heard Ashok's footsteps in the hall and the door opened behind me.
"Don't come in,"
I whispered.
"She's nearly there."
"Himmler had something similar." Ashok stayed where he was.
"But poor old Goebbels had no balls at all."
And just like that, she was asleep. I waited a moment, placed my turquoise cashmere round neck over her to keep her from getting chilly, and then I climbed to my feet.
"You can leave her here if you like," I whispered.
"Ilari's in the kitchen with the other two. I think she's..." I turned and let out a yelp. Sam stood in my doorway, his arms folded and a half-smile on his face. A holdall sat on the floor between his feet. I blinked at him, wondering if I was hallucinating, and then my hands rose slowly to my face.
"Surprise,"
he mouthed silently, and I stumbled across the room and pushed him out into the hall where I could kiss him. He had planned it the night I had told him about my unexpected free weekend, he told me. Jake had been no problem. There was no shortage of friends happy to take a free concert ticket. And he had reorganized his work, begging favors and swapping shifts. Then he had booked a last-minute cheap flight and come to surprise me. "You're lucky I didn't decide to do the same to you," the thought did cross my mind at 30,000 feet. I had this sudden vision of you flying in the opposite direction. "How long have we got?" "Only 48 hours, I'm afraid. I have to leave early Monday morning, but, Lou, I didn't want to wait another few weeks." He didn't say any more, but I knew what he meant. "I'm so happy you did. Thank you. Thank you. So who let you in?"
"Your man at reception.